now we're going to get to our speaker. Though Steve and I go way back, I'm going to have someone special do the honors of introducing him. Tammy Walsh used to work with Steve. Prior to starting her own company about 5 years ago, I got to know her when she was at BKD, but she had a consulting company before she got lured to the big boys, I guess, right? And now you've gone back to the company that you started a while back. Mm-hmm. And she was, BKB is a member of three of our four chapters in Texas. And she would come regularly. She was a regular at our North Texas Healthcare Think Tank meetings. And we got to know each other quite well. Tammy is the CEO and founder of Paramount Healthcare Solutions, a consulting firm focused on guiding physicians and clinics to advance and improve processes and strategies to ensure patient satisfaction and overall positive bottom line for the organizations. She is also busy serving as Vice President and Innovation Officer for the HFMA Lone Star Chapter. I think that's Healthcare Financial Management Association. As well as chairing the statewide HFMA Texas Conference 2021. She enjoys teaching as an adjunct professor at TCU for their MBA program. So with that, I'm so glad to see your happy face, Tammy, and why don't you introduce our speaker?
Great. Thank you, Linda, for that kind introduction, and good afternoon, everyone. I am honored and thrilled to get to introduce our speaker today. When I saw his name come across in the calendar from Linda, I immediately called her and said, I want to introduce Steve. And you see, Steven and I worked together, as Linda said, in a past life. He was always my favorite colleague. We both worked at American Medical Response, which is an emergency services organization. You're going to hear a little bit more about that from Steven. We had responsibility for 22 markets in the South region. I from the finance function and he from the operations function. I remember this was my first exposure to emergency medical services. So I made a deal with him. You teach me transports and I'll teach you budgeting. So one of the most thrilling, albeit sad, portions of our role together was deployment of our ambulances in the midst of disaster, like a hurricane. And you're going to hear about that here in a little bit yourselves too, but you would not believe the operational logistics that has to occur when something like this happens. I remember that as a finance person, I was there and wanted to help, but couldn't do much from a finance perspective. So I begged for them to give me a task. So they sent me on an errand to Walmart to get overnight items. I just wanted to be a part of the team, but we were up for 24-hour periods at a time, no sleep. So while we were all running on adrenaline, I was thrilled to get directed for this task. But at any rate, those moments will be something that will be embedded in my mind forever on what happens when the nation is pulled together to support a disaster. Again, you'll hear about that from Stephen later, but let me tell you a little bit about his career. He is currently regional president for operations in the South region for Global Medical Response. He brings experience in marketing, management, and clinical application to his role in overseas integrated air and ground operations in 8 states across the Southern U.S. Prior to returning to GMR, Stephen served as the Vice President of Global Marketing for Innovative Trauma Care and Director of Marketing for VitaCare Corporation. Prior to this, he served as the General Manager for the South Division of AMR, where we were together. Additionally, with 20 years of experience as a licensed paramedic and his service as a combat medical specialist in the U.S. Army National Guard, he knows the clinical aspects of the emergency medicine thoroughly. With that said, I remember many times during our travel days, if we were at an airport and there were uniformed personnel eating, he would always pick up the tab anonymously. And from that moment on, seeing the look on those young soldiers' faces that someone picked up their meal was so heartwarming. And I've since done the same when finding myself in the company of soldiers. So what a great feeling that brings to oneself. So I challenge you to do the same. Needless to say, Steve continues to lead his team, now being called Global Medical Response, as they've incorporated air transports with their ambulance service line. So they have made themselves into an innovative provider of care model in a low margin, very high stress environment. So I'm so excited to hear his stories. I'm sure you are as well. So my friend, Stephen, the floor is yours.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. I could tell you many stories from our travels across the South region, or I guess then it was Central region, or South then. We started a small operation in Las Cruces, New Mexico together and spent many, many, many times having to travel there to get that operation up and running. And it, you'll be pleased to know we're still providing service in Las Cruces, New Mexico. So that one's still going. So in fact, we were talking about that earlier today. So as we said, we're going to be talking a bit about COVID-19 and its impact on emergency medical services. And I will talk a little bit about global medical response and what we are and why we even have the relevance to talk about, the impact of COVID-19 on EMS as a general topic. I'll try to explain a little about the EMS business, because I think it's important that you understand some of how EMS works as a business, because without that, it's going to be hard to really understand the impact of this pandemic on the system and why it's such a stressor for us. But first, as Tammy mentioned, we're no longer just an ambulance company. We started out as American Medical Response, and through a series of acquisitions and private equity deals, we're now conglomerated into a company called Global Medical Response. And it includes AMR, which is a ground service, but it also includes fixed-wing medical transport, both prop fixed-wing, which you see in the background, as well as jet, rotor. We also do fire, mostly community fire and some industrial fire. And other ambulance response. We also do special events, like we're the ambulance provider for many NASCAR tracks and football games. In fact, at the Cowboys game this weekend, we'll be our personnel providing medical support for the Dallas Cowboys and a number of other NFL teams across the country. So our system covers a wide variety of pre-hospital, post-hospital, and out-of-hospital emergency medicine, or medicine. And we're also doing a number of very innovative things, like we're doing a nurse call center where we're allowing, like in Washington, D.C., where if somebody dials 911 with a low acuity complaint, instead of just getting an ambulance, they get routed to our nurse call center, which then gets triaged and may potentially be given a call for a lift to take them to a doctor, a doctor's office, rather than to a hospital. So there's a variety of solutions that are out there that we're utilizing to try to change how emergency medicine is practiced in the U.S. To give you a bigger picture of what the company looks like, we did about 10 million patient transports last year. We're about 38,000 employees. We serve about 4,000 communities across 48 of the U.S. states. We've done fixed wing or jet transports to every single continent in the world. We have 66 comm centers in the U.S. Several of them are what we call super centers, which are large comm centers that are integrated with other comm centers. So for example, during Hurricane Maria, I think it was last year or the year before, when we had a flooding take out a generator in our Miami comm center, we were able to, within 12 hours, transfer both calls and radio dispatch to two other comm centers in different geographic locations and keep those centers functioning and keep the crews in communication. So it allows us to have disaster redundancy, even if we lose the physical structure of a comm center. So we're trying to implement that on a wide basis across a large number of areas. Important to note on this, and this is relevant to the business aspect of EMS, and for all of you who are on the operations side of business, I'm sure it's jumped out at you. Emergency medicine is a people and capital intensive business. And this is what makes it some of the challenges in this industry, is that we're very capital intensive. I mean, every one of those rotor aircraft are a few million dollars, right? So all those clinical personnel, these are high dollar, highly trained personnel. So these are things that create a lot of management challenges in terms of the business aspect of this industry. My region itself, as Tammy pointed out, is multiple states across what most normal Americans would call the Southwest, but at GMR we call it the South. Long histories of how that happened, but this is what we call it. Goes from Texas to Nebraska, over to Las Vegas, and back to Texas. We have about 266 ground, or 266 operations, 92 ground, 174 air bases. I have about 11,000 employees under my direct leadership, and we do about 1.4 million transports a year. So it's a large area, and it's geographically widespread. And so we have a wide gamut of everything. I've got everything from a high performance EMS system like Las Vegas, which runs as many transports a day as my entire Texas operation runs a day, to very rural operations like Milam County, Texas, which runs a handful of transports a day. So I have the whole gamut, everything from super rural to high urban, high performance EMS. So with EMS, with COVID, I wanted to break it down to try to give you an idea of how it impacted us and what it means for the larger EMS world, and hopefully what it to stimulate some conversation of what does it mean for healthcare in general and possibly even for the larger, you know, U.S. economy, and what does it mean for us to how we're going to have to incorporate this? Because I think it's important to note that while I think COVID is going to diminish, you know, there's a certain aspect of it that's just not going away, right? I think there's a part of it that's like the AIDS epidemic or the Hep B or Hep C that's going to become endemic to our society, that we're just going to have to learn how to incorporate into how we function, how we work, and how we interact. And if you haven't heard this before, I apologize for delivering the bad news. But it's just something that is part of our, is going to be part of our healthcare fabric, that I know a lot of us in healthcare are starting to try to figure out how do we break this into our normal way of functioning. So that's what a lot of this presentation is built around, is what was the impact with the response phase? What did that look like? And what were some of the things we had to do on the fly to manage it? I wanted to spend a second talking about what we had to do with our personnel to help them get through it. And then I want to talk about some of the things that we've learned and what we've done to challenge, to address those things we learned, and to ask some questions that I hope will, you know, get people thinking. I honestly don't have all the answers in this presentation, so I'll have some open-ended questions at the end that honestly I don't have a real good answer for on how we're going to respond to everything that COVID has brought up for us. But as I mentioned before, the first thing first is you've got to understand how EMS works. In the United States, and EMS is different across the world, but in the United States, EMS is an efficiency model system. Pretty much regardless of where you practice, whether it's a municipality or a private agency, they operate off the same basic fundamental economics. Transports equal revenue. We do not get paid if we don't transport. So if we treat on scene, there is no money. There are some places that will pay a small amount of money for treat on scene, but it does not cover costs, so you might as well just disregard it. It doesn't really matter. About 40% or more of our payers are state or federal payers, Medicare, Medicaid. So our payments are fixed by state, by annual fee schedules that are established by governmental entities with no real consideration to the cost of the service we're providing, right? Now, one misnomer that a lot of people don't understand is that while in a physician's practice, Medicare in many cases is fairly lucrative, in a EMS practice, Medicare is barely above cost, right? And so it's a very marginal business for Medicare for us, right? So it's the exact opposite of what most people think of with Medicare. And Medicaid is absolutely below cost. So you will not find a business savvy ambulance provider who's hunting for Medicaid transports. They don't exist, because Medicaid is just something you do because it's part of the business. The other part of we talked about earlier, the highest variable cost for us is labor. And we talk about this all the time with new managers. Is you don't count Band-Aids. I don't care about the med supplies. They're almost irrelevant. All you really need to care about, even though, you know, a vent circuit might cost $150, that's almost not material compared to how much labor it took to count the vent circuits in your inventory, because your labor is everything on the pre-hospital system. So your highest variable cost is labor. And the other piece is that response times equal cost. So, and this is the most complex portion of EMS for people to understand, is if you want a 6-minute response time for an ambulance, what that means is I have to have an ambulance sitting there unoccupied within 6 minutes of where you're located when you dial 911, okay? So for me to do that, I have to have a high probability that I have an ambulance within 6 minutes of your location. So for me to do that, I have to run a variety of statistical models and keep a certain percentage of my resources unoccupied. The shorter the response time, the more resources I have to keep unoccupied, which means, as all of you who might run on the operations side have already done the math, the more cost in my system. So it's a very straightforward inverse math. The shorter the response times, the more cost in a system. You want a 2-minute ambulance service, we can provide it. It's just extraordinarily expensive because you have to have a lot of vehicles sitting around doing nothing. Now, in many systems, there's an efficiency that occurs with high volume. Like, in, for example, Las Vegas, we have so many transports and so much volume that, statistically speaking, the odds of an ambulance being available are high because there's so much churn. There's just so many patient transports. Everything's so close together that we can run a fairly efficient system and not have to rely on taxpayer dollars because it's just such a busy system. But that only works in the very big, very high volume urban setting, places like Fort Worth, Dallas, you know, San Antonio, Austin, Las Vegas, those places where they have a lot of volume and there's a lot of activity, so they can do that. And they don't require a lot of tax base to support them. The in places where there's less volume and there's less resources to support them, you end up seeing tax supplementation to get to a lower response time, because that's the only way to provide those resources just sitting around. So that's how the different EMS systems come up. So that's sort of a crash course in EMS. If you're ever bored, I'm sure Tammy can tell you a ton about EMS system finance. I'd be happy to talk to you. I can nerd out on EMS finance for years. It's a fascinating topic, but it is one of efficiency and how tightly you manage the resources being allocated to the system and how well you manage those. So with that, I'll dive into the COVID piece. Now, one thing I would note, and I know somebody's watching the comments, so I feel free to interrupt. If you have questions, don't hesitate. I'll be happy to answer them as we go through it. Now, with COVID, what happened when it first started was like any other infectious disease event. We actually even have a name for these kind of outbreaks called HCIDs, or high consequence infectious disease. We have teams trained in them, and you can see a couple of those teams over here on the right side of your screen. The ones with the bubble wraps, that's a high consequence infectious disease transport team. We have those in Texas. We have them in all of our states. We have a number of people trained to transport those patients. Things like Ebola, dengue fever, patients like that. We're prepared for that kind of an outbreak. And when it first started popping up, that's what it sort of looked like, right? We had a handful of hotspots, and these are some of the hotspots we responded to across the country. And they were isolated. They might have been intense at the local event, but they were relatively isolated. And then you take the data coming out of China, and it had a relatively low mortality based on information we were getting from China, which we all know now was not quite that accurate. And once we started getting data from Italy, and we realized, oh my God, this is a lot more fatal than we realized, particularly for healthcare providers, because then we started to learn that it's the viral load that was getting you, not necessarily just being exposed. By the end of March, we started realizing, there's something a lot worse here than we were prepared for initially. But it started off just like a normal outbreak of diseases. And I say normal in the EMS sense, normal, in that it's just everyday crazy that we realized, okay, well, we can respond to this and manage these kind of outbreaks. But then we have March, and March comes and the bottom drops out for everybody, right? And most people were focused on New York, but you saw the climb in states across the country. This chart gives you the best visual representation of what it was like from an EMS perspective. To orient you to the chart, the gray bars are volumes. This is the number of transports that we did. The blue line is an efficiency metric we use called UHU. You don't have to worry about UHU, but it's just how efficiently we're managing our ambulances. And just like we talked about before, the more efficiently I manage them, the more financially solvent my business unit is. And so you can see what happened around March 14th, the volume bottom fell out. We stopped, our number of transports dropped like a stone. And at the same time, the efficiency of our ambulances dropped like a stone. And that's what's interesting about that, because normally what we do when volume drops is we stop putting as many ambulances on the road. And so efficiency would normally taper off and it wouldn't drop so far. But the reason it didn't is because what's missing out of this graph is how many times we had to respond. Because with COVID, what was happening is people were still calling for COVID calls. We just weren't transporting them. And so they were calling, the hospitals were telling us not to transport them unless they were in extreme condition. So we would go, we'd assess them, we would tell them they need to follow up with their physician, and we would not transport them. So going back to the EMS model, that creates a ton of cost, no revenue. And so it puts this huge burden on the EMS system. Plus it ties up resources. Add to the insult to injury, you're exposing the crew members to COVID at the same time, right? So we have this massive complication going on associated with this. So it's not like we're all sitting around doing nothing. These crews are responding to calls. They're just not transporting patients. We have system overload in some major markets as well, like New York, New Jersey, and other locations. And on top of that, special events were canceled across the board in most locations, which is another area where EMS systems work to support themselves. So you have basically every single revenue-producing aspect of pre-hospital medicine was destroyed in about a week and a half whenever COVID struck. So it was quite a shock for the EMS system. Now, as Tammy will tell you, and as she articulated during the response, the beautiful thing about emergency medicine, and it goes all the way through to management, it's rare in the time of a disaster that anybody asks about money up first. The first response is, where are you? And we just go and we figure out the money later. And that's exactly what happened. And we're just now starting to try to figure out the money. One thing I do want to point out on this graph, and I'll talk more about that in a second, but the recovery is not the V that we wanted. Right. And I want you to look at that and remember that a little bit as we go through it. I don't know if you can see my arrow, but we have this massive sharp drop. I mean, we're talking from March 7th to April 4th. We plummeted a 30% drop in volume, and we're still not at pre-COVID levels. We're still running 10 to 15% below plan in most markets. Some places have recovered, but most are quite a bit below where we're supposed to be. And you can see how long that's drug out. We'll talk a bit more about why that is. And that's one of the big warning signs that we're trying to figure out of what's going on. So starting in March, we had a 61-day deployment that was activated for New York City. And this is tied to what Tammy talked about. Now, prior to COVID, most of our deployments were for hurricanes. And they were relatively short, usually 2 to 3 weeks. And we'd send ambulances out. We'd transport a handful of patients, but mostly was there just to back up the community. New York was nothing like a hurricane deployment. We showed up and we hit the ground and we were responding. In some cases, some of my employees who deployed, they said they didn't even get a chance to take their suitcases out of their ambulance when they showed up. They were getting dispatched on calls the moment they hit the ground. We deployed 350 ambulances to New York City. We did 34,000 responses and transported 17,000 patients. What was interesting about that, and those numbers sound big, but it really doesn't even tell the tale. They were incredibly busy, busier than any other deployment we had. But a data point came out in New York City that was fascinating that plays into those recovery numbers and why the volume dropped so precipitously for EMS. Is that we started seeing this ridiculously high number of cardiac arrests. So normally in an EMS system, cardiac arrests account for about 1% of your volume. So if I ran 100 calls, I'd have one cardiac arrest, a person who's dead that we do CPR on and hopefully get them back. We were running in New York City somewhere around 10%. So it was 10 times the volume of cardiac arrest what we would normally expect in an EMS system. We were trying to figure it out, and we were asking our colleagues from New York NY EMS, and that was higher than their normal volume. And what we have finally deduced, and our best hypothesis, is that people were not calling EMS. So instead of calling when you had chest pain or when you had the early signs of stroke, you didn't call because you were scared to go to the hospital, so you stayed home. And nobody called until you were in full arrest. And so you saw this dramatic increase in cardiac arrest. So that's why you started seeing all these public service announcements of telling people, call EMS, because we saw a measurable impact of the people being afraid to call EMS in terms of how many patients were going into cardiac arrest before we arrived. And for those of you who are close to those healthcare information, you'll know, while we have come a long way to resuscitating cardiac arrest victims, it is far better to go to the hospital when you're having chest pain than waiting until you're in cardiac arrest. Your survival rates are substantially higher. So it was where we're there where we first started seeing that interesting factoid that illustrated one of the challenges of COVID and the unintended, or I guess the collateral damage that COVID's caused, that's probably not going to be encountered in the total death toll of COVID. in New Jersey, while we are still doing the 350 ambulances in New Jersey, we were asked to deploy another 195 units to we were still doing 350 to New York. We were asked to deploy another 195 to New Jersey. That deployment lasted 38 days, where we deployed 845 caregivers. They did 9,900 missions and 4,200 transports. In this setting, it was similar to New York City. They were busy, extraordinarily busy. They also saw the same pattern of high volume of cardiac arrest patients, higher volume of cardiac arrest patients than what we would normally see. And as we started digging into the data, in every community where we had a high number of COVID patients and a high public awareness of COVID, we saw an increase in cardiac arrest, probably not as pronounced as it was in New York and New Jersey because of the extreme public awareness of how overloaded the hospitals were. But there was a measurable change in the number of cardiac arrests that we believe is directly linked to people's a fear of calling EMS because of fear of contracting COVID. Shortly thereafter, we started a deployment in South Texas along the valley. We still are deployed there. We have 57 ground vehicles down in South Texas with 238 personnel. As of yesterday, we did 3,970 patient transports serving 11 jurisdictions, and we've been on deployment 54 days. So this right now, COVID has represented easily the longest continuous deployment for our FEMA relationship since we started the contract, and we started it shortly after Katrina. So it gives you an idea of how extreme the COVID impact was in terms of our national exposure and how much we've had to contribute in terms of ongoing resources. Now, the good news is no employee or very few employees have been there the entire time. We rotate them out. We generally try to pull employees out after about 30-day deployment and rotate in fresh employees so they don't get burned out and get them home to their families and give them a chance to recover. Admittedly, some employees love it. They don't want to leave. But there's, you know, we try to force people out to get them some breaks, even if they don't realize they need them. As anybody who's worked with EMS people will tell you, they will work themselves literally to exhaustion to take care of other people. So it's sometimes we just have to force them to take a break when they're in this kind of mode, particularly in a disaster. They love this. They're fully engaged whenever they're in this particular mode. So when we started digging into this, we were trying to figure out what was driving all these factors, because we had to figure out how to respond to it and how to mitigate them in our systems, or at least identify which ones we could mitigate. Some of the first things we identified is that telehealth really had its birth during COVID. And how many of y'all, and it's just sort of a straw poll for the videos, at least the ones I can see on video, how many of y'all have refilled prescriptions by telehealth now, right? I mean, I know I have, and now it's so amazing. I would preferentially choose a doctor who did telehealth refills versus one who didn't, because it's so much better than sitting in a doctor's office for 3 hours waiting to get in. We believe that we're seeing some of the reduction in EMS is because the person who's complaining of pain, who previously couldn't get in to see their doctor for a few days, would just call EMS and go to the hospital. And now the doctor's saying, I can't get you in, but I can put you on telehealth. And they're seeing them, getting them a prescription and taking care of them. Now, I think that's a structural change. I think that's a real permanent change to the healthcare system in the United States. Now, I don't know that that's a bad one. I think it's a more efficient use of healthcare, but it's one that we're going to have to adapt to, that we're not prepared. We weren't prepared for prior to COVID, because telehealth really hadn't taken off quite like it had. This treatment on scene that we started with COVID and we're continuing to do with COVID without transport is driving significant costs without any funding mechanism that we know of. So it's something that we're going to have to work with our elected officials to figure out, how do we change the EMS model to where we can treat people and not transport them, that the only incentive to manage a patient is to transport, because otherwise, you know, you're going to start really taxing the system financially if many of these patients are going to be treated at scene and not transported. An interesting challenge is we had to deal with, and I don't know how many of y'all might have saw it, is that early on there was a number of fire stations where the entire fire station had to go on quarantine because they were exposed to COVID. This happened in a lot of places. I actually had at some point in some of my locations, I had as many as 20 employees on quarantine at any given time, which was a tremendous staffing challenge that we had to manage through. So what we had to adapt to is reducing on-scene personnel and come up with some very interesting patient contact approaches where one person would put on full PPE, do an initial assessment of the patient. Once they identified if the patient was a high risk for COVID, then everybody would put on full PPE and make contact. If the patient was identified as low risk, then the rest would come in without the PPE. I mean, it was quite the process that we had to go through to manage how many people got exposed and also manage how much PPE we were burning through, because that was another factor. I mean, the personal protective equipment was a finite amount of resources. And the other piece that was an interesting adaptation that I think was brilliant on the part of the communities that presents a challenge for EMS in terms of how the system is designed is a lot of communities set up COVID hospitals. Like they take an old decommissioned hospital and reactivate it and or set up a tent city or convert a convention center to a COVID receiving facility to protect their main hospitals from being contaminated with COVID or from becoming overrun with COVID. Which I think is brilliant. The problem is EMS is only paid by transport to designated destinations, right? So we did it. We transported a lot of patients to those places. We're just not sure we're actually going to get paid for any of that. So those are some of the things that we're working out on the back end to try to figure out, are we ever going to get paid for any of these transports we did during this? And if not, how do we manage this to work with elected officials in the future to where EMS doesn't get crippled because we're doing the right thing up front. The most important part, though, was the impact on our caregivers. Now, this picture is a picture of one of my employees from Las Vegas with Mercy, one of our therapy dogs that we have deployed across our region. We had, for all the hype about the disease, one thing that's important to note is that it really is a potentially fatal disease. In my company alone, we've had 4 EMS personnel killed by COVID. These are not decrepit, ill people. These are people in the prime of their life, much like the person you pictured here who was actively working and productive, and they got sick and died from a disease like COVID. And this is pretty serious stuff. And this does not include the number of people I've had, quite a few people I've had who did develop severe illness, and another not small group of people who have developed severe illness, recovered, and then had lingering reoccurrences of severe illness over a period of weeks and even months after their initial experience. So there's a lot we don't know about COVID still, and there's a lot that we don't know about what it does to the body that we're seeing play out in the bodies of some of my employees. So it's definitely something that is putting a lot of stress on my team members and causing them a lot of personal health risk. So we take personal protective equipment very seriously in how we try to protect our employees. What aggravated it and added to the stress is that COVID was coming out during a lot of allergy seasons and late cold seasons. And so people would develop COVID-like symptoms, think they had COVID, go through the stress cycle of thinking, oh my God, I got this potentially fatal disease, then get tested and find out, nope, it's not that, it's just the cold. I had a bout of bronchitis during this, and I had to get tested like 4 times. It was just this huge process. And you develop that fear, like, oh my God, do I have it? Am I going to die from this thing? You're afraid, am I going to give it to my family? Am I going to kill somebody in my family, my grandparents, or somebody like that? So there's a lot of anxiety that gets circulated with that the care providers struggle with. I know personally several of my employees who would go home, have a change of clothes in the garage, they'd strip naked in the garage, put on a different change of clothes, put all their uniforms straight into the washer and run the wash, and then go inside, take a shower, change clothes again, put those clothes in the wash, and then contact their family. And that was what they did at the end of every single shift. So there was a lot of anxiety associated with COVID. Now, I don't know if that's a little extreme, but in their mind, that's what they needed to do to have peace of mind that they weren't going to give it to their family. And then add to that, we had constant process and procedure change. And you would think EMS people are change animals, but the reality is they are not. They hate change because they live in a world of constant change. Their patients change all the time. Their environment changes. So they like their work environment to be constant. And when you change their work environment, they do not like it. And we changed their work environment almost daily as we adapted to COVID. And so it was not a fun time for them as we were constantly pushing out new procedures and new processes and new decon steps and new report to work procedures. We had a lot of anxiety about financial stress. If they get sick, what happens? How do they get paid? What happens if they go out for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 6 weeks? And then at the same token, same stuff that all of y'all had to deal with. What happens with childcare when all their kids have to go stay home? They had the same challenges every one of y'all had with your employees and your workplaces on top of the increased risk for exposure and infection. So we had to implement a number of programs. We've invested a tremendous amount in mental health. We've added a chaplaincy program to most of our major operations. We've brought on a mental health team that works with our deployments, as well as you can see our website, we've produced a number of mental health tools that we try to push to our employees. It's an ugly fact that EMS has got a very high suicide rate. In fact, the first responders, I think the average life expectancy of a first responder is in their mid-30s, and that's largely because of suicide. So it's a significant problem that we have to constantly battle. So it's something we were addressing prior to this, but the added stress of COVID is something that's really accelerated our efforts to try to combat suicide and mental health problems in emergency medicine. We've also developed tools to try to streamline access for people into facilities to make it where it's less cumbersome, like our facility access screening tool, which helps get them in the building where it's not so difficult. We got therapy dogs, so they do have dogs they can play with at various operations, which seems silly, but it's amazing how much stress it relieves for them to play with a dog. We also have childcare payments that we pay to employees in markets where childcare has been suspended. So we pay for we give them a stipend for childcare to help fund some childcare support. And we also implemented early on a process, because what we found early on is it's impossible to tell if they got the disease from working on the ambulance or if they got it from community exposure. So we just decided to treat everything like it was work exposure. So if they contract COVID working for us, or if they contract COVID and they're an employee of ours, they're automatically put on paid leave. After a given period of time, they're put on workers' comp. And so we, rather than letting them have that anxiety about, work compensation and payment, we just automatically push them through that channel. So the only caveat on that is they have to participate in screening, and they have to work with us to make sure that it's not, a paid vacation, which we always have to watch out for the scammers. So we've tried to do a number of things to help take care of our employees through this. I feel like we've done a generally decent job of making sure that we manage through that. But it is definitely a big challenge, and it's something that we're blessed because we're a large organization, so we have the resources to do it. Not every EMS agency has that capacity, so it's something that's a challenge for some folks. So some of the things that we've had to really work through is the PPE piece. That was a massive challenge, and as Tammy pointed out, the logistics of it is a huge issue. You just can't appreciate until you get in there how much material has to be moved around to make an EMS system function. During COVID, we had to build up almost overnight an $8 million cash just to support our operations to keep us functioning through COVID-19. That's on top of our normal inventory and our normal functioning date and just-in-time inventory system. To give you an idea of the increased burn rate of masks alone, we, in the first half of 2020, we used 214 times as many masks as we used in all of 2019. We have purchased, let's see, this one blew me away too, 684 times as many gowns in the first half of 2020 as we bought in all of 2019. So the logistics load is massive. And what's interesting for parallel industries, some things have almost disappeared. Ironically, like the EZIO, our purchases of that have plummeted. our purchases of endotracheal tubes, the breathing tubes, have dropped because we don't use those right now because it's shown with COVID it's not good for the patients to intubate them. So our ordering pattern has shifted dramatically. So our suppliers are having to shift dramatically to catch up with that. So I imagine, though I don't know for sure, there's some pretty impressive bullwhipping happening all the way through the supply chain as people are trying to adjust to ordering patterns, particularly from somebody like us. We had to deploy mobile fogging units to help relieve some pressure on our employees. So we literally have in our big operations teams the people who just go around and decontaminate ambulances. And we talked about the employee piece, and we've had to adapt to new business models. So now we have COVID testing teams that we go out, and that's a new business model that we've had to deploy, as well as symptom screening teams to try to take over business opportunities that we did not have before. Because of the loss of businesses that we previously relied on. So, and you'll see that you're seeing that with a lot of EMS agencies, not just private entities like ourselves, but a lot of agencies are trying to branch out into these new fields, trying to replace some of that missing revenue from loss of transports or special events. So I know I talked a lot and I talked fast, so I apologize, but, you know, some of the things that we need to do, just in closing, just to prompt maybe some questions or discussion or just some thought after you get off this presentation, if you have an opportunity to think about it, is the reimbursement model for EMS has got to be reevaluated. COVID-19 has accelerated modernization of the healthcare system in the United States. The healthcare system in the U.S. was really designed around an efficiency model. And it was designed around the hospital. And as you've seen, we've pushed towards telemedicine. We've pushed towards outside the hospitals because of the overload challenges. I think that's a good thing for the healthcare system. I think it's efficient. I think it's going to be overall cost-wise good. But it's a totally new system, and it's going to have to be changed. The funding's going to have to be changed to keep that shifting moving. Without the change in funding, that shift is going to die on the vine, right? And EMS has to be a part of that shift. We have to expand and reimburse for telehealth. I think there's a huge opportunity for EMS and telehealth, and it's something that's got to be part of the funding stream. And there has to be some support for local and regional supply caches. I think I'm blessed because I work for a very large company that can handle building up an $8 million cache. Not every ambulance service can do that. Not even every urban or metropolitan EMS service can do that. So the reality is there needs to be some governmental support for caches that can be drawn on by these agencies that don't have the resources that a company like myself would have to be able to build up those supplies. Because I do know for a fact there's a number of agencies that we've had to loan equipment to who ran out. And it's not because their managers were evil or bad or irresponsible. They just didn't have the depth of resources. And I think that's something that needs to be considered in terms of the larger response to that. And then finally, you know, the ultimate question is what else? And that's the one I don't really have an answer to, is because we're still in the midst of it. You saw the recovery is still relatively flat. We're not really sure how much of that is structural. I'm certain that there's a certain amount that just is not coming back anytime soon. What it's going to look like, I do not know at this point. And I think, I do believe, based on just some of the things that I've seen in the literature and in general, I do think COVID-19 is not going away in the traditional sense, right? Not in the eradicate smallpox sense. So I think learning how to adapt to it and learning how to function in society as well as in healthcare is a huge task that we all have in front of us. And so the what else is, how do we adapt as business people and how do we adapt as healthcare providers to that new world with this in place? It's much like, how did we adapt to when HIV was, we all had to realize that HIV is not going away. Though this is much harder because it's respiratory. And so it's a much harder one to manage around. So that leads us to that open-ended question that, you know, while EMS, I can point out all the challenges that we focus on, to me, it's almost like the canary in the coal mine. I think that the healthcare system in general has a large amount of challenges that we've got to figure out. How do we adapt to a world with respiratory viruses of the COVID-19 nature that are not going to go away, that we have to adapt to and be able to respond to and be dynamic enough and still maintain some form of our efficiency model that is effective. It just needs to be robust enough to handle this kind of a spike in demand. And that is all.
Great, great talk. Let's have questions. Yes.
It's Ron. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I am retired complex care doc, but for years I ran all the level two nurseries in Cincinnati, and it took me a while to figure out, but what I found out after a number of years was the anesthesia people, since they didn't bring the patient to the hospital, the OB did, they were guaranteed payment on any Medicaid or non-paying patient, and I was eating it. So number one, the hospitals are willing to, or seem to be, when I was around, willing to negotiate. Second of all, until the hospital bought me out, I was in private practice managing the chronically ill kids I inherited, and nobody else wanted them in the same way as you're managing most of the EMS, which is very important. We use you a lot. And so I went to Medicaid and said, I keep people out of the ER, I get them home sooner. And I'll take these patients, but I want 110% of normal. I don't want 80% of normal, I want 110%. Let me know what you think. And they looked at my record and they came back and they said, well, we'll give you 3 months and see how you do. And prior to that, everybody told me you can't negotiate with Medicaid. Now, I didn't have kids that I had that were over 21 actually could get Medicare. There's a thing for chronic illness where you could get Medicaid, Medicare, but I didn't have that many. So I had Medicare, but I didn't have that many negotiations. But I would just say to you, it may have changed, but I think there's room to negotiate. As for telehealth, I think you're the ideal thing. And I'm still on the listserv for complex care, which is Canada and the United States. And we negotiate as a group, and because many of our patients live a state away, or it's just hard for them to get out, or it's bad weather. And so we made a proposal, and I would think, you know, you're on the scene and you're talking to the hospital and you're basically doing a telehealth visit, but you're an ideal telehealth user. And, you know, you may need to get some physicians and other people to support you, but I would think you should be right in there. The telehealth I get right now is almost comical, in that most of my docs don't give me any monitoring equipment, and they call and ask me, how am I? And as a physician, I find it a little humorous that I happen to have monitoring equipment in my house if they ask me to go to check stuff. But they don't, and I wonder. I sympathize with them. They're hurting, but I can't picture how they're gaining anything about my condition by the way they're conducting it. Those are my comments. So,
thank you. No, I agree completely. I think there's a number of opportunities for EMS and telehealth, and because we bring the monitoring equipment with us, right? So I think that's a huge advantage. We basically can be that hands of the physician particularly for the complex telehealth case.
And you'd get the support of the people who are involved with those kids. I think in 2 seconds, I can't picture anybody being against you getting that attention. Other than that, nice presentation. Glad you're there.
Melissa, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I do. Stephen, thank you so much. That's I had no idea how complex EMS work was. And when you started doing the numbers for faster response time, I went, ooh, this is, you know, this is super complicated. So great presentation. I assume, you know, people talk about the second wave this fall plus added with the flu. So have you had to do more planning or put planning in place or have meetings so that you guys are prepared for whatever they're referring to as the second wave?
We are. And we're also, most of our work right now is trying to emphasize flu vaccination. So our most of our effort is employee protection. If I can keep my workforce from getting sick, I can generally, I've got the resources to handle pretty much most of what could happen. The biggest threat for us and what hurt us the most early on in the COVID outbreak initially was the large number of our employees who were on quarantine. I mean, there were some operations that have 20, 30% of our paramedics on quarantine, and that makes it a huge challenge to be able to respond when a big chunk of your workforce is no longer available. So we're really pushing flu vaccinations right now. And I encourage that strongly for all of you. If you haven't already had one, I recommend you get it. If nothing else, because the flu is going to be complicated because it's going to be hard to differentiate flu from COVID. So you may think you have the flu and you may actually have COVID or vice versa. So it just helps simplify the diagnostics, if nothing else. So we're doing that effort right now. And then from there, it'll be a case of monitoring very closely with the communities. We have active tracking in most of our locations where we're working very closely with emergency operations centers to track COVID cases in hospitals, as well as COVID-like symptoms in 911 centers with COVID screening questions and those types of things. So we try to track it very closely. We're so far seeing a really good trend in most communities where the numbers are going down. But, you know, if we start to see an uptick, then that will kick the gears in motion to increase deployments or increase resources on the road.
Steve, I had a quick comment, and you brought back a lot of memories, and that was always so exciting to do for the financial part of this. You know, a couple of things folks don't realize is we need to call you all providers. You know, we know folks as the vendor partner side and then providers, and then EMS is just left out of that, but you're providing care too. So I want us to make sure of that. And, you know, the reimbursement is key because I remember when I first looked at the income statement when I came on board, it was red. It was a loss, and I didn't understand. But what a lot of people may not understand is when they call 911, you don't get to choose. They don't get to ask, well, do you have insurance or not? I mean, you have to go from a federal regulation. You have to attend and not pick and choose what transport you're going to do. So I think that's important. So, you know, if there's a lot of uninsured or the Medicare and Medicaid population, that's a big key. But I wanted to make sure that folks knew that. And so when there's regulations and laws that's coming into effect, because I know that you all and Tarrant County has MedStar, I know that you all are there in front of the politicians trying to get that passed and so forth. So I want folks to kind of be aware of that as well. But I was curious on home health. And okay, so take the disasters out of the equation, move it out of the equation, because EMTs was the biggest shortage we had. I remember that was my first part of being, you know, the shift schedules. I mean, that was a nightmare to do these shift schedules to have enough people. So I want folks to, number one, if you want to be an EMT, you really should because there's a shortage. But it was, you know, keeping that staff and the constant turnover of folks that we had and then trained. But how has this played into the baby boomer prospect of, you know, the home health and more folks, you know, being there? I mean, has that been an uptick for you all over the last few years?
Well, we, home health, well, it's interesting. That's a great question. One, staffing is an ongoing challenge. So that's always a challenge where, you know, we joke that we never stop hiring paramedics. We actually never stop hiring. But even when we're fully staffed, we never stop hiring. And part of it's not just because there's a certain amount of turnover, but because it takes a long time to train somebody. So from the day you get hired, it's anywhere from 3 to 6 months before you're able to actually provide care in one of our systems. So I don't know what my staffing is going to look like 3 to 6 months from now. And so I'm not going to stop hiring because odds are I'm going to need somebody in 6 months. So I'm going to go ahead and hire you, go ahead and get you in the training program. And then we'll worry about if we have a home for you at the end of 6 months. So we don't ever stop. So generally speaking, we're in the constant hire mode. When it comes to home health, we have up until recently not done a lot with home health. Now, one thing that we've interacted with home health now is a system we call mobile integrated health, where we've worked with hospitals to do some advanced home health-like kind of care, where we work with them, like an example of a program we do out of Austin with some of their cardiac surgeons, where we do post-surgical follow-up and we monitor the patients in conjunction with the surgeons. And it's just a slightly higher level of care, and we use that with paramedics or critical care paramedics for these really specially identified cardiac patients that require somebody who can monitor them but also could defibrillate them if they needed to, right? So it's not, you don't want to have like an LVN who shows up and who suddenly now has to dial 911. You want somebody who can handle whatever might happen regardless of what's going on that particular house call. We also work really closely with hospice programs to do some of that type of home call to prevent them from actively calling EMS and getting engaged in that component of it.
Okay, Steve.
For the record, there was no doggies there when I was there. I wish there were some puppies, dogs there when I was there.
Oh, no, the dogs are awesome. I have one in my office and he always tries to steal my lunch. That's the only thing I don't like about him. But otherwise, they're pretty amazing.
Change your dog food. He might like it. Thank you all for coming on this. We're a few minutes past the time, but I think everybody will agree that this was a fantastic program. I learned more about EMS than I thought I'd ever need to know, but it makes us aware of we need to legislate on your behalf because we've got to have that kind of assistance, and it needs support of our representatives. So we'll help you with that.
Just real quick, I wanted to, if I could, before Mike asked me a question about CARES funding, there was a little bit of funding, pretty much about one payroll worth of funding that came out of CARES. Now, it came with a hook, though. Because we accepted it, we can't balance bill. So we have to accept whatever we get paid for patients, which is fine. We accepted it, but that's a huge, wide open possibility. We don't know what that actually means for us because we don't know what anybody's going to pay for COVID patients. So it could be good for us or it could be terrible for us. We just don't know at this stage. But we did accept some CARES funding. With CARES 2 or any of the follow-up CARES programs, we don't know what they're going to do at this point.
Wow. Okay, folks, thank you very much. You will get contact, you've got contact information for Steve. If you've got any additional questions, please get in touch with him.
All right, feel free.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Much success to everybody.
Yes. Thanks, Steve.
Hi, Linda. Bye, Linda.
Hey, Ray. Call me.
Okay.